Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partner in radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, just you and me again this morning. This is becoming the norm rather than the exception. When I stopped receiving pictures from Ron, which was a day or two ago, he was in Dallas. But this morning he indicated that he's in, quote, a remote part of Texas. Is he at like a dude ranch? Do they have Ron doing like manly stuff, like to break him? Is he like riding horses or like roping cattle? What's Ron doing in a remote part of Texas?
My internet investigative journalistic skills tell me that they were at the Magnolia. I don't know. What do you call that place with the two big silos where all the shiplap comes from?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say the shiplap place, the Chip and Joanna Gaines place, right? Which is in Gaines, like...
It's in Waco area.
Yeah, Waco. Yeah.
So that was within the last day or two. And so, you know, I wasn't aware that Waco was particularly remote. So maybe they've gone from there to somewhere more remote.
Well, you know how it is. I mean, you can't get internet in Waco. You know, I mean, it's just too hard. You know what's interesting about that to me is that Ron positions himself as sort of so unique and so different, and there's no one like me. And yet, I feel like every Christian white couple between the ages of like 25 and 70 have made the pilgrimage down to the shiplap place where Chip and Joanna Gaines are. I wonder how he's going to frame that on social media. You know what I mean? If it'll be like a wink, wink.
To be fair, the picture was of Big M, which, you know, so there's already a framing there in that, you know, this is a meaningful.
I'm doing this for my wife. Yeah, yes. I'm a good husband. Yeah, big sweetheart. Yeah, that kind of.
I'm sure he bought some apple butter or whatever it is. They probably don't do apples in Texas. I don't know, beef fat butter or something from them.
Yeah. Well, keep an eye on the socials. We'll definitely see what's going on. Pipe, after this quick break, you and I are going to talk books. You and I are going to talk some different book categories, some favorites, the kind of activity that Ron doesn't enjoy being put on the spot about. I want to talk about Ron's history with books, too, because I feel like when I met him, how long ago did you meet him?
It was when we were doing the podcast, so like he... Yeah. So it was so when Trogues and I and you were doing the podcast, whatever, like 8.5 years ago, at one point, I think you had to be out speaking at a camp or, I mean, this was your life was kind of wild back then because maybe it was when you were moving to Tennessee. I'm not sure. But and Ronnie sort of guest hosted with us.
Yeah.
That was the first interaction I'd ever had with him.
Yeah. See, I met him probably 15 years ago. And when I met him, he wasn't like a book guy. You know what I mean? He wasn't like, hey, look at my bookshelf. You know, he wasn't that guy. Or like, I'm hosting a book club. And now, like, he's that guy. So I don't know if he was that guy all along and it was just pre-social media, so nobody knew. Or if he kind of came into the book guy thing, like, later in life. But at any rate, we're going to talk about books, and we'll do that right after this short break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in... Anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Pipe. We're back. You texted along some categories that you had thought about a long time ago vis-a-vis talking about books. And I want to start with a heater, man. I want to just start with a hot one, with a controversial one that's going to offend some people right out of the gate, at least on my end. And that is this: a book that is beloved that you can't stand.
I'm sure when I wrote these questions down, I had a very particular book in mind, and I was trying to put that one on a tee, and now I have to remember what it was. Let's see.
Dude, if you want to think for a minute, I've got one. I've got one dialed up. It actually, it brought me some heat this week at camp.
Okay.
It's Lord of the Rings. Oh. I'm just not a Lord of the Rings guy.
Yes.
I'm just not, dude. And any, I'll say this, in that genre, I'll give a couple of caveats. I mean, I admire what the author did with it. Obviously, it's masterful, and I could never do it, and I admire it. And I just have this thing where if the book involves like a fantastical created world, I'm just out. If it has a dragon, I'm out. I just have no interest in any of that stuff. And I'm sure it's an amazing book for someone else, but it's beloved. And you know, without fail now in Christian circles, especially like younger person Christian circles, which are primarily like very Tolkienian, homeschooly kind of circles, someone will ask me what I think of Lord of the Rings, and I'll have to be honest. And then, you know, they'll come at me for a little bit.
So. When was the first time you read it or tried to read it?
Gosh, I want to say probably college or post-college. Like it didn't drift across my transom in childhood like it did for most people. And I think here's the thing. I think if my parents had introduced me to it and been like, oh my gosh, this book is so special to us, you're going to love it, I think I would have gone for it. You know, I think I would have been in. But I don't know, in college, you're kind of focused on yourself. Hey, maybe it was the wrong time. Maybe I should try it again.
Maybe. I mean, if you hate the genre, I'm not sure it's going to do much for you, though. Like, there has to be a certain sort of kind of love of the fairy tale. And I think, you know, if you read, you know, you read Tolkien, you read Lewis, you read Chesterton, all these guys write sort of in defense of fairy tales.
Sure.
And really what they're writing is in defense of imagination.
Yeah.
And so that can go a different way. Like, you don't necessarily, in their day and time, that was, you know, ghouls, ogres, the fantastical characters, you know, that kind of stuff, which I love. You know, I've loved that since I was a kid. Like, it captured my imagination at like 5 and holds it still. But imagination can go any number of ways. So I get not liking the genre. Like, that's not lost on me. I feel the same way about the vast majority of like literary fiction that is popular today.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
Which is, you know, where it's sort of like you're just sort of living inside someone's emotional, spiritual, relational mind as they navigate, you know, a relationship or a breakup or whatever. And I'm like, this is literally my job. This is the same crap I have to listen to people talk about. I'm being particularly cynical right now. I actually like people, but when you're trying to sensationalize what is actually just like, man, you need help. It's a really dumb genre. So I get despising a genre. I think, a book that I dislike that everybody else seems to like, I'm going to go the other way on this one, and I'm going to pick The Chronicles of Narnia.
Oh, fascinating. Talk about
So I don't hate The Chronicles of Narnia. And when I was a kid, I genuinely loved them. But I went back and read them a few years ago, and I was like, Lewis can't write fiction very well.
Interesting.
Like, they're just not good. They are kind of allegorically brilliant. And there's these, you know, there's like sections of text that you're like, this is spectacular.
Yeah.
Except those are the sections of text that are the most reflective of Lewis's nonfiction. Mm-hmm. You know, something you read in like The Weight of Glory or whatever. Like, there are a couple of them that the Voyage of the Dawn Treader is the closest, I think, in that whole series. Uh-huh. And then the, why am I blanking? The nephew,
Yeah, I don't know.
Whatever. The one that is first chronologically and last in the order you're supposed to read them, Magician's Nephew. Those two, I think, are really good books. The others, I'm just like, I don't know. These read like kind of dime a dozen kid stories with a strong Christian twist to them. And I will go so far as to say, I think a lot of trash Christian fiction can be blamed on the way that Lewis wrote those. Because he wrote with such a clear, like, and this is Jesus type of twist that people don't know how to write broader fiction with a Christian kind of eye on it. They're just like, well, we got to have a Jesus figure. We got to have an evil figure. We got to have like a, and I'm like, everything doesn't need to be allegorical.
I know. Right. That's fascinating. So a follow up question to that. Have there ever been two authors ripped off more than Lewis and Tolkien? Because, you know, like teaching college, every incoming freshman has like 35,000 words of their Tolkienian ripoff novel, like, already written nowadays, like, which is kind of cute, and it's kind of sweet.
That's particular to a college full of homeschoolers. Let me go out on a limb here.
I mean, yeah, but, like, that idea, that kind of heavily allegorical, this thing stands for this thing, I feel like that was the purview of Lewis and Tolkien, and it's been just ripped off a whole lot. Can you think of any other authors that have been, or ideas that have been ripped off to that degree?
Let's see. I mean, I think what stands out about them is that they moved Christian writing, or writing as Christians, from like puritanical, and I don't mean that as a criticism, but rather more like a genre,
right?
Into a much broader sort of, so Lewis on his nonfiction side was, you know, he was apologetics. It was Christian thought. It was sort of how to engage ideas through the lens of, you know, deep Christianity. And Tolkien, he wasn't writing allegorically. He was writing fantasy fiction, which is a thing that was kind of dead at that point. Like, he was so out of the norm. But writing it with a classical sense of sort of virtue, you know, courage, friendship, bravery, self-sacrifice, these kinds of things. And so what they did was they sort of introduced whole ways of thinking that people didn't learn how to think like them. They just tried to duplicate what they do, which is why when you read somebody like, say, Tim Keller, it pops. Yeah. Because he did pick up the ways of thinking of Lewis and then translated it to the 20th and 21st centuries.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're so right. And yeah, it's fascinating to think about it that way, right? To think that Christians writing fiction didn't really exist as a thing before those two. And that honestly makes me a lot warmer to it. And not that I'm cold to the idea of these two authors, but it just stylistically isn't a fit for me.
And I want to, be clear. I don't hate the Chronicles of Narnia.
Sure.
I just don't resonate with the Chronicles. Like, they are upheld as borderline, you know, canon.
Canon,
and
absolutely.
And I'm like, they're fine. You know, I'd rather read, you know, the Princess and the Goblin and some of those kind of older stories that actually influence Lewis, that I'm like, this feels like fantastical, pseudo-allegorical fairy tale fiction, but written better.
Yeah. Do you think those books meant so much to people? Because I'm sure you've had this experience, and I have too. Like, from time to time, I'll run across like a 55-year-old man who's like still obsessed with, you know, Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia or whatever. And I oftentimes, I think that book must have entered this person's life at a really formative childhood time that they're sort of idealizing. And I say that with great affection, because like, idealizing the past is a part-time job for me. It's like the thing I enjoy doing the most. But so for somebody, it was probably, you know, Chronicles of Narnia. But for me, it was I don't know, George Plimpton's Paper Lion or whatever that makes me think wistful thoughts about childhood, which makes me think everybody probably has something like that. So, you know, for me, it's Paper Lion, the kind of book that I don't want to say it made me want to be a writer, but it's sort of like opened my eyes to the fact that football and writing could coexist.
Yes.
Which was pretty cool. Are there any books like that for you from childhood that were just like turn on the light bulb kind of books that you know kind of got you thinking about being a writer?
Well, it's interesting when you talk about the obsession thing, because one of the things that stands out about that to me is that obsessing about those books feels counter, like decidedly opposite to what those authors would have wanted their readers to do.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, they're trying to open up imagination and horizons, and instead people get smaller and smaller as they like learn how to speak Elvish.
Yeah.
And you're like, you have shrunk yourself down to a fictional world instead of realizing this is supposed to sort of lift your eyes to like, oh, there's not only a world of fiction and imagination, there's a world of virtue and of good and evil and friendship and all these different things. And so I when I see stuff like that, I'm like, that's sad. I mean, you see the same thing with like Harry Potter, which are books that I thoroughly enjoyed.
Yeah.
And same with the movies and Jim Dale's audiobooks. They're all just delightful and have that sort of classic story to them. I think Tolkien would have looked at J.K. Rowling's work and been like, see, that's what's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
You're supposed to sort of take hold of this concept, these ideas, and tell a different story.
Right.
Tell a different story for different ages, those kinds of things. But when people get obsessed with them, they miss the point. And so, it's kind of a sad twist on the imagination piece. In terms of books that captured me the way you talk about Paper Lion, I think, I'm trying to think, Friday Night Lights.
Oh,
and,
man.
And that one comes to mind specifically because you mentioned football, but Friday Night Lights was one where I realized that like the mundane is not mundane.
Right.
And so it shifted my, and so I think I read that as maybe a freshman in college, which was also the most poignant time because I played football through high school, considered going out for Wheaton's football team. And I probably would have been a guy who could have made the team and maybe played by the time I was an upperclassman some.
Yeah.
Like definitely not a star player, not an elite athlete, but adequate enough. And I just decided it wasn't worth the time and effort for me.
Yeah.
And I desperately missed football as a freshman in college.
Yeah.
So then I read Friday Night Lights and it is the most... It was the most nostalgic thing I had ever experienced at that point in my life about a very non-nostalgic story. Like the story is really about how nostalgia turns into like a weird twisted idol that puts a ceiling on all of life.
Well, absolutely.
You know, you got these guys who like won a title 15 years prior are still wearing around their state championship rings while being total deadbeats in a dead end town in West Texas.
Right.
And, so it was just, I was like, the sports is not a game. It's a human thing because, you know, what Bissinger did in that was tell the stories of mundane people in a mundane town.
Right.
In a profoundly human, deep, relational, painful way.
Right.
And you know, and it layers of it. And so, that was one that I was like, you can tell stories about anything, really.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and he did it in a way that's like, it's really universal, you know, like he wanted this sort of ubiquitously American experience and, you know, he chose Odessa, Texas. But my experience of reading that book, kind of like yours, was that it was nostalgic for me, but he didn't intend it to be nostalgic, right? So he was just doing reportage. And in fact, I think he went to great lengths to keep kind of his own interior life out of it. You know, it wasn't about his emotional experience with West Texas, but in allowing these people to tell their stories and just doing great reportage. Like, I had this experience with it where early in my marriage, I gave it to my wife to read, and I'm just like, look, you didn't know me in high school, but read this. You know, this will
yes,
this will inform a lot of what my life was like before you in terms of the good stuff and the bad stuff, right? Like the idolatry of football, which is bad, and which by that point in my life, I knew it was bad. But then also, like, all the romantic stuff, you know, and all the sort of...
And the power of it.
The power of it.
In sports and relationship, in both good mm-hmm. and bad ways.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. And, man, that book is brilliant. I teach it in one of my classes at Union. And it's always, I think increasingly as the years go by, it's jarring to students, right? It's jarring because of how honest and kind of raw and real it is, but he's not trying to be shocking. I mean, it's not like a modern, you know, like a modern novel where
yes,
all kinds of depraved stuff is happening.
And he does not draw out anything.
Right.
You know, in the sense of like, he doesn't sensationalize anything. So when you get mm-hmm. the delusions of Booby Miles about greatness, even after it's clear that his career is over.
Yeah.
All that the book does is put that in front of you and let you stare into the bleakness of it. Like, he's not
That's
like,
right.
And this was so horrifically sad because of X, Y, and Z. He's just like,
and Booby was a victim and they used yeah. him. Yeah. I mean, which is totally what would happen now.
You know, what was it? Mike Winchell's, the quarterback's kind yeah. of his own sort of insecurities, anxieties. All he did was describe it.
Yes.
And then he let yeah. Winchell describe it in his own words.
Yeah.
And so you get all these pictures, the same with, was it Coach Gaines? Was it Gary Gaines?
Yeah. Gary Gaines.
And yeah. Same thing with him and his interactions with this town and the pressure and the idolatry of football and all this stuff. And so you just, it is a bleak book in the sense of just like, it's a little bit like Cormac McCarthy Writes Football.
Dude, yes, that's a great comp, actually. It's a really good comp.
And to be fair, the East Texas setting really works for that, too. Like, if it was in, like, the lush hills of Virginia, it would feel different. But,
yes.
You know, the nothingness of East Texas, which is, I think, yeah. part of the reason he picked that, because he's like, there's nothing here. There's no economy. There's no beauty. There's no nothing. There's just football.
Well, yeah, and he did a great job even with that. Like, with the... Just the socioeconomic history of the area, you know, which he went into at great length. And my students tend to be torn on that. Like, some of them find it really interesting. Some find it boring. I found it fascinating because it sort of framed why football was so important, you know, because football yeah. is sort of the chief export of the community that stayed, you know, relatively robust as the economy has swung wildly in one direction or the other. And it is
yeah, definitively boring, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it's boring in the same way that the answer to so many questions about power and like, well, why follow the yeah. money?
Yeah.
Like that's,
yeah.
I mean, I imagine in journalism classes, like if you were teaching investigative journalism, that'd be like somewhere in your top 3 points would be
yeah.
follow the money. Cause
yeah,
that's
100%.
That unearths all sorts of power dynamics and history and all this stuff. So it's not interesting in the sense of like, boy, there was a lot of explosive action.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating in the sense of this is why the town is the way it is.
Yeah. Dude, I want to take another quick break and do a couple more Friday Night Lights things with you right after this quick break. All right, Piper, back. Let's go just quick on a couple of Friday Night Lights things. Who's your favorite character? Can you remember back that far?
Man, let's see. My recollection is there was two characters. There was a Brian.
Brian Chavez, yeah.
Yes, Brian Chavez. He's, and he, correct me if I'm wrong, he's like the Harvard-bound,
yes,
like brilliant guy, one of the only sort of truly hardworking academic
smart
students
football players.
And then
yeah,
also
yeah.
an utter savage on the football field. Is that
yes.
am I thinking of
yeah,
the right
that's
guy
him. Yep
yeah
yep.
I think Chavez was maybe the most interesting character to me for that reason. I mean, you have the fact that he's Latino, he's an academic just he's busting his chops, trying to trying to make it there, and a killer on the football field. And those two things don't usually go hand in hand. So he stands out to me a lot. And then the older I've gotten, so I re-listened to the book a couple of years ago, and Gaines became a lot more meaningful to me as a, well, I would have been like 38 when I listened to it, you know, so very far removed from high school and much closer, maybe exactly where he was age-wise, life-wise.
Yeah, Gaines is a fascinating figure because his problems are very adult problems, but he lives among teenagers, you know, and like it's sort of like the chess pieces that he's moving around the board are teenagers, but the pressures, the money, the, you know, do I play this injured player, you know, even the way he speaks to them, which I don't know. I think if you played high school in football or you played football in high school, the way Gaines talks to his team scans as sort of romantic and nostalgic. But if, like, my wife reading it was like, he's manipulative, you know? And I'm like, well, yeah, every high school football coach
every
is manipulative.
Good coach is.
Well, yeah, you're trying to get people to do things that are insane, you know? Like really, you're trying to get boys to do a very manly thing, which is go and try to hurt each other, you know? It doesn't make any sense. You sort of have to be talked into it in most cases. So, yeah, I thought Gaines was fascinating. So where are you at on the movie? Because I'm all in on the movie to such a degree that I couldn't do the TV show. I think people ride with one Friday Night Lights thing or the other. Are you a movie or a TV show guy?
I'm both, but in the same way. So I'm going to use an example that you have to deny all understanding of. Sure. I loved the movie because it captured the book really well. It was cast well. It was acted well.
Yes.
The pacing of it, all of it was brilliant. And it is nothing like the Friday Night Lights TV show. So, which I also really enjoyed for its own sort of like saccharine ridiculousness and like Hollywood over the topness. Like, okay, that's fun. That felt more like a typical sports movie.
Yeah.
But just over the course of like six seasons or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So the comparison is this. The movie is like a really good craft beer.
Mm.
And the show is like a Miller High Life after mowing the lawn. These are not the same beverages. Yeah. They call them both beer. They are not the same beverages.
So I don't understand, especially if my employer is listening. I have no idea what Pipe's talking about.
Yeah, you don't have any idea. Okay, it's like the difference between Coke and Coke Zero. Like, they both have Coke in the name. They are not the same thing.
That's right.
So you can understand.
That I can wholeheartedly appear to understand.
Put it in Baptist parlance. Sweet tea and unsweet tea, except that doesn't work because unsweet tea is just trash. But But that's kind of how I view them. Where I'm like, one of these has its time and place, and it's enjoyable for its thing. But it's like it's not the real thing. And then the movie is the real thing, and it's excellent.
Yeah, it's so good, dude. And I almost can't get enough of it. You know, I think I watch it every fall. Tristan's really fond of it, and we just really enjoy it. Great stuff. All right, let's get to another category here. Let's go guilty pleasure book or author. Guilty pleasure book or author. Do you have things like this?
Yes, I 100% do. Not like guilty, like I'm embarrassed for moral reasons, but more just like in terms of literary quality, these things are Twinkies.
Yeah.
I am a total sucker for like a 20-book series about a single law enforcement character.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Like the Mitch Rapp books where he's, you know, he's just the world's greatest assassin and spy. The Scott Harvath books by Brad Thor, same thing. There's like 20 of these. The Daniel Silva's Gabriel Alon books, again, there's like 20 of them.
Yeah.
And the Walt Longmire books, the Jill Pickett books. Like I do most of these on audiobooks because you can get through them a lot faster.
Yeah.
And also like they're kind of perfect for audiobook because like when I'm sitting down to read, I want to enter sort of a certain mental space of thoughtfulness and I want to have a pen in hand and kind of be, I want to get some nutrition out of it, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas audiobooks are like, tell me a story, just captivate me while I spend 2 hours in the car.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would say those are my guilty pleasures. And I'll go up and down the line, because, like, I'll go all the way down to, like, David Baldacci, and, like, his books are garbage. Like, they're such bad writing.
Yeah.
But delightfully ridiculous characters, you know, like a huge, there's like a huge, massive, overweight pseudo detective who he had a brain injury that now makes it so he has a photographic memory, and I'm like, and amazing. He's got a whole series of books about this guy, and they're called the Memory Man books, and I'm like, these books are so dumb, but I will listen to all of them.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. So I'm going to put you on the kind of radio chaise lounge for a minute. Why, you know, for a guy who you worked in publishing before what you're doing now, which is being a pastor. And there are a lot of guys like this, probably myself included. I never wanted to be a cop, you know? So, like, I never had that experience of, I don't know, just being a kid and wanting to be a cop, you know? But I'm kind of with you on cop narratives. Why are they so interesting? And so, like, what for you, as you think about your own life, your own, like, interior life, what's kind of the entry point or the on-ramp for all these cop stories for you?
Oh, man, that's a good question. Because the thing is, I enjoy movies very similarly. Like, I have to be in the right frame of mind to do, like, I watched Whiplash the other night for the first time. We can discuss that on a different episode.
Dude.
You've brought it up in a couple episodes. Like, that is not... light entertainment.
Correct.
And I knew that going in, so I was kind of in the right frame of mind. But then I will watch all the James Bond movies or, you know, the Extraction movies that are, you know, with Chris Hemsworth, where it's just like explosions and action. Yeah. And I love it. I'm a total sucker for it. And I think it's, so I think part of it is I spend the vast majority of my mental energy reading and studying things that are pretty dense. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that in an arrogant way. It's just like when you live in sort of a theological or, you know, teaching realm, there's a lot of sort of mental muscle work that goes into it.
Yeah.
And so, like, I need to have, like, the pendulum needs to swing kind of far the other way for me to find just sort of sheer kind of mind-numbing enjoyment.
Yeah. No, I get it.
I think the cop thing is, like, there's part of it just sort of like, it is a bit vicarious in an absurd way.
Yeah.
Like, not man, I wish these guys existed in the real world, because, like, when you read a book or listen to a book about a vigilante cop, you're like, I'm glad that's not the way it works most of the time. That seems terrible. But also, boy, that's fun. I'm glad that guy just pulls out his gun and shoots the bad guys. Like, that's pretty cool.
Dude, yeah.
So, well, there's sort of a vicarious aspect. There's sort of an absurd aspect. Mm-hmm. And then there's just sort of like I think there's just the high of action.
Yeah, definitely. An action that's happening to characters that you've decided to care about. And not because you know everything about them, but just because you know enough. And the author gives you enough, right? So, if you're going in on a cop narrative, chances are you care about the guy a little bit. And vis-a-vis the vicariousness, I totally agree. I also think there's something for a dude. There's something in it of, like, what would I do? So knowing that I'll probably never be in these scenarios, like, still, what would I do? And you kind of do the work of thinking through, if I was a cop, how would I handle this? So there's that. But then there's, like, I don't know. And you and I, by God's grace, you know, we have lovely wives and lovely families and kind of, I say this with great affection, boring suburban existences. You know what I mean? Where, like,
I think no stable one's, like, is the word you're looking
stable.
For.
Stable. Yeah, stable. And, like, nobody's firing bullets through our windows, thank God. And, you know, so we're not sort of confronted with these things. But I think part of the escapism is, like, you get that shot in the movie of, you know, the cop going back to his kind of gritty apartment in the city, and he's like, you know, flopping down on the sofa and just pulling the bottle of bourbon or whatever right out of the freezer and pouring himself a little bit. And, you know, there's something kind of gritty and free about that, where it's like, this person answers to no one. You know, he's not getting up in the morning and deciding like who's going to take the kid to school. You know, he's like, he rolls out of bed, like shakes off the hangover, and is like, I'm going out to catch bad guys. There's kind of a single-mindedness about that that's pretty cool.
But it's also far enough removed from our reality that we can be like, thank God I don't live like that. You know, like I don't look at that with jealousy. It's kind of like superhero movies, except closer to home. Because like maybe I used to live in a crappy apartment like that. Like I've never flown around with a cape, so like whatever. Yeah. That's its own version of entertainment. But this is like, you know, that I have lived in squalor before. I have been a broke single dude before. And then because if somebody wrote it, like the cop movies where they try to deal in the moral complexities of balancing family and being a good dad and being a good husband and do you take the shot or not? And all, like, that's not an entertaining genre.
Yeah.
It might be a captivating genre if it's done well. It's certainly a thought-provoking one. There's a lot there. But if I just want to be entertained, I want the moral simplicity of what you just described. Like, we have taken all the variables off the table. This man lives for the job. And really what he lives for is his own sense of justice.
Yeah.
He has a moral compass that lives in his head, and that's what he's following. He just happens to have a badge and a gun.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's very appealing. So I'm going to ask you another question. Where are you at on the kind of cop trope of the good guy has to become bad to catch the bad guys? And I'm thinking specifically of two movies. One is The Untouchables, and the other Public Enemies, Michael Mann thing from, I don't know, a decade or so ago. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, the cop was kind of this, in the first act, he was sort of this apple-cheeked, like, I'm a good cop, I'm a good man, I go home to my wife and three kids, and, you know, we have dinner and listen to stories on the radio or whatever, and by the third act, this guy is like, you know, morally compromised but successful in catching the bad guy. I feel like that's a cop trope that I find kind of interesting from time to time. Where are you at on it?
Oh, it's definitely interesting, especially as a moral thought experiment.
Yeah,
you know, the sort of rough men stand ready in the night type of thing. Which I think realistically, like if you look at the world in which we live, you go, sometimes we need men willing to do violent things to stop bad men from doing more violent things to innocent people.
Yes.
The question is, where are the borders on the moral or ethical borders on what will our violent men, like where will they stop?
Right.
And then can they turn it off? You know, that kind of thing. So as a trope, I get it. It's also part of the reason why that sort of like isolated, grizzled, you know, beef jerky, dried up husk of a cop works because he's already the bad man. Like he's either denied himself. He's sort of an ascetic. He's either denied himself everything or he's lost everything because his
he couldn't control it. Yeah.
Sweet, gentle, wonderful wife was like, I can't live with you if you're like this, which is heartbreaking. But like he's kind of moved into that space of
he's been burned up inside.
I am the rough man who exists purely to fight the bad men. And so it's we don't wrestle with that nearly as much in like a military context. You know what I mean? Like
the lines are a lot clearer.
Right. And so which, you know, that leads to all sorts of questions about like, what's the difference between policing and military and so forth, honestly, like that's a complex conversation. I think there should be a very big gap between those two things. But, as a sort of character trope, I'm kind of here for it.
Yeah.
Where a good storyteller will, like Craig Johnson, the guy who wrote all the Walt Longmire books, writes this stuff really well. Because over the course of a series of books, the main character, Walt Longmire, kind of becomes more vigilante in various contexts, and what it costs him in friendships and relationships elsewhere, or how those friends are sort of his conscience, is pretty fascinating. And Johnson does it well. He writes it pretty well. Others are just like, whatever, we're going to keep it simple. This guy just shoots folks.
Yeah. So I have a follow-up question on that. You and I are both like really drawn to that kind of thing, you know, to either burned up vigilante cop a la Walt Longmire, or the kind of good guy who has to become bad. He has to do some violent things. I don't know. That resonates with me at a deep level, and it feels not all that far from reality, right? Like, it feels like a couple of moves down the chessboard and we could be there. And my wife and I love this show. It's an Italian cop show called Rocco Schiavone's Ice Cold Murders. And he's sort of that figure, the kind of burned up inside, got to do some questionable things, but he still has some charisma. He's still like well-liked around the office. I don't know. It's like, if there were a million episodes of that, I would watch all of them. I would watch one every day. You know, like, I will never get tired of that kind of character. But there are people, there are men, Ronnie is one of them, who would have no interest in this whatsoever. And if he were on the program right now, he'd be falling all over himself to talk about how boring this is and how uninteresting it is to, like, think about men being
he'd be falling all over himself to not talk at all and just let his silence declare the boredom of this whole thing that we've spent 12 minutes discussing or whatever it's been.
So my question is, like, what is it about him or about people like that that make them not interested in this? Because I don't get it. I don't know how anyone could not be interested in it, I guess, is where I'm at on it, you know?
I'm not sure why people resonate with what they resonate with. What I find fascinating is our propensity to sort of to rank what we are interested in a sort of we are superior to you way. So, you know, if Ronnie's guilty pleasure, as he has declared, so I'm not like outing him here, is like Christian romance fiction.
Right.
He is going to see that likely as superior to the kind of moral degradation of violence and all that stuff that we just described really enjoying. Whereas I look at that stuff and I'm like, that's just like licking corn syrup. That's just disgusting. And so we are drawn to what we're drawn to, you know, and I think the reasons for them both are similar in terms of like, it's sort of an enjoyable turn your brain off. You come away. It sort of feels like you just sort of had your, all this dense thought sort of scrubbed from your head. You can just sort of be like, okay, that was pleasurable.
Yeah.
And maybe something vicarious in there, you know, if Ronnie's more of a feeler and you and I are more like, I just want to do something, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe Men one day I'll get to do something heroic or active. Yeah. I don't know. And, but I look at his stuff and I'm like, that is so stupid. And he looks at mine and thinks the exact same thing. That's what's fascinating to me about this is that, like, okay, I don't know why people are drawn to what they are.
Yeah.
I do find it hilarious that my guilty pleasure is less dumb than your guilty pleasure.
Yeah, that's true. That is such, like, a part of the guilty pleasure paradigm that's baked in, is judging someone else's guilty pleasure, for sure. Whereas, I guess, the Christian romance novel and the cop novel, they kind of exist on the same organ to me, in that they're, and you made the point, right? They're sort of both equally shallow or non-rigorous or fun, but they're just fun in different ways.
Well, and they're they're both utterly unrealistic. They're both, you know, I could make points about, like, you called that one Christian and this one is definitively not Christian, which means mine is at least honest, but whatever, that's picking nits.
Pipe, we got to take our third ad break, and then I want to come back and I want to ask another Ronnie-related question germane to romance novels. We'll be right back. All right, Pipe. Admittedly, I haven't read maybe any Christian romance novels, but I feel like I'm familiar with the genre. I'm trying to frame this question in a certain way. So as Ronnie's reading this Christian romance novel, who is he sort of identifying with in it? Because even the rough-hewn, like, blacksmith who moves into town and woos the school teacher is still sort of like many gradations away from, like, the persona that Ronnie is doing now. So as he's reading, does he, like, kind of superimpose his own experience over the blacksmith? Or is he in a weird way kind of the school teacher? Do you know what I'm asking? Like, yeah. Where's Ronnie in the frontier paradigm?
I kind of suspect that he's not sort of putting himself in the character space as much as, like, you know how you turn on mood music?
Uh-huh.
You're going to have a bunch of people over. Like, what is the vibe of this group? Is this like a high energy thing? So you turn on something that's, you know, not like party music, but like,
it's got
a groove to it. People, it keeps the party moving. Or do you want like, you're going to put on like Miles Davis and bring this thing down a little bit. It's just going to be chill.
Contemplative. Yeah.
I kind of think Ronnie reads these books like that. Like they are, they're the mood, they're like emotional mood music kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so it puts him in a place of like, man, there's just happily ever after, and like good things are happening for folks, and like it's good to see people coming together, and like you know, I think conflict is very stressful for Ronnie, whereas you and I maybe sinfully so really maybe take a little bit more enjoyment out of some good conflict. Like let's let's pick a fight. Yeah. That sounds fun, and and so I kind of think it's sort of. Mood music on a page.
Okay. That actually makes a lot of sense. And I don't know, for me, like to get into a book, there has to be something in it that I can, like the phrase relate to is not quite adequate for this, but I have to be able to see some aspect of like either my experience or some idealized future experience. I have to be able to see that in a book. You know what I mean? Which is why I couldn't read, I don't know, a book about like, I don't know, lesbian paleontologists or whatever. Like, I'm not a lesbian. I'm not into science. Like, there's just no way I would read that book, you know? But if there's even like a little crackle of overlap to my own life, I could get into it,
let me ask you a question about that. So that you have hit very close to a reading experience I've had over the last few weeks. Okay. So I've been reading a handful of stuff. So Anthony Doerr is an author. He wrote All the Light We Cannot See. That's the book that everybody knows by him. Yeah. You know, won Pulitzer Prize, brilliant book and like brilliantly written, but also like a great story.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm going to read other Anthony Doerr stuff.
Right.
I hate it all, as far as I can tell. Like, at least what I've found so far, because his writing remains sublime. And I don't know another way to put it, because it has sort of it's sort of a subtle draw you into a sort of dream state kind of thing going on.
Yeah.
None of his characters matter. None of his stories resolve. At least, you know, again, I haven't read the full breadth, but a couple of short stories and his first novel that he came out with. And so my question in light of this is, you know, he doesn't write about lesbian paleontologists, but he's not that far off. And there is something in the writing that keeps me turning the pages. Even though I abhor the story itself. And I'm like, this is not worth recommending to anyone. How do you, where is that merger for you of like, the writing is so good, I'll keep going. Versus this story is so dumb, I'm quitting.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And that's where I think, and you're probably like this, I'm guessing, like the craftsman aspect of this, you know, the fact that we're both in the writing business, right? So if I'm reading something and the writing is exquisite, but the story means nothing to me, like you, I'll probably keep going, you know, and because I enjoy seeing a craftsman work, you know, and I mean, to some degree, Infinite Jest was like that in the sense that like, there's so many characters and you don't care about all of them. And clearly that's a book with a point, right? Like, even though it took 1,200 pages to do it, like he was making a point about entertainment and the culture and how we're going to destroy ourselves and all that stuff. So like, but on a page to page level, it really just was about the writing. you know, and yeah, I'll stay with a book like that. Not always, but a lot of times I'll stay with a book like that. And I think it's because I'm in the writing business, you know, and I think more so than Ronnie, and definitely more so than like my wife, who I really admire as a fiction reader, I'm so grounded in the world of reality that like I have to be able to get something from it. You know what I mean? The book has to either move me forward as a writer or be something I can relate to. Whereas I really admire people who can read a book that has nothing to do with them in any way and still enjoy it. I kind of wish I was more like that, you know?
Yeah, I feel like the merger point of like good writing versus bad story mm-hmm. in a book is mm-hmm. a very different place than like with a movie. So like, what was the movie I just mentioned? Whiplash.
Yeah,
I would venture to say Whiplash would be akin to a brilliantly written book with a very unsatisfactory story.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
However, in a 2-hour movie with multiple performances going on, that is a very different experience because the acting was great and the writing was great. And the story, while unsatisfactory, was thought-provoking. You know, it was open-ended and kind of like, oh, okay, I'm gonna chew on this one.
Yeah.
A book is not satisfactory. And also, you're talking minimum, usually with novels, minimum 300 pages of commitment to this. And so I feel like, I mean, I give it like a chapter or two before I'm like, yeah, I'm out. Nothing here is hooking me. I can't do this. That's the way I feel about like all Marilyn Robinson books would be another one that like people in our camp love them.
Yes.
And I've tried and tried and tried again, and I cannot get past about chapter two. And I'm like, this, she can write definitively, brilliantly, and I do not care. I do not care about anything on these pages. And
That's hard.
And so, I'm just like, I'm not giving it 350 pages of my time to something I can't care about.
Yeah, and like the heart wants what the heart wants there, you know, and like it's sort of like we care about the stuff we care about. And I mentioned it a couple of episodes ago. I just finished reading this book by this boxing promoter from Philadelphia, and the writing was like definitively mid, you know, and he was a journalism major in college. So he had some like he could write, he could tell a story. But the structure of the book was basically him going through every fight card that he'd ever promoted and like talking about the fighters and then explaining if it made money or not. I mean, it was really like not necessarily intended to draw in a broad audience, but I was kind of like transfixed by it. I'm like, if I'm going into this book to learn about the life of a boxing promoter, I have learned it, you know, like he has given me that. And because I care about that for some reason, it was interesting to me, but like for the vast majority of the people, that would be a boring book.
Well, that's how I feel about like Jeff Perlman's books. You know, I'm working my way through his Bo Jackson biography right now, and he's written. I mean, his strength is in picking his subjects and getting access.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And so phenomenal information on super interesting subjects, and he's just a mediocre writer. Like it's not.
I agree. Yeah.
If you go read like Roland Lazenby's biography of Michael Jordan or of Kobe Bryant, you go, that's a biographer. Like that's Walter Isaacson level biography stuff.
Sure.
And then Perlman is like, nah, he's not that good. But man, these characters, the characters that he's writing about, the stories that he heard about him, his access to like their next door neighbor when they were in third grade is phenomenal. Like he works to collect the stuff for those books.
Yeah, he's a workhorse. He's a journalist, though, not a writer, you know, and there's a difference. He's a reporter, and he's a very good reporter, and to your point, a very forgettable writer, but those books are so fun to read. Like, I'm looking over at my bookshelf right now at, like, the Perlman Favre biography, which was a blast, the Walter Payton one, which was amazing, the one on the 90s Cowboys. He, maybe more than any other kind of popular nonfiction writer, he's perfected the thing that he does, you know, like there's a Jeff Perlman thing. And when you buy that book, you know what you're getting, It's a great, like, get it for Christmas kind of book because you know you're going to enjoy it. There's no risk involved.
Yeah, and he knows his audience, and it's like men of a certain age. Yep. You know, who cares about Bo Jackson, men of a certain age? Who cares about the USFL, men of a certain age? Exactly. Who cares about the 90s Cowboys? Same group of dudes. And he's just cranking out books that he's like, there are, I don't know, 50 million of these men in the United States, and if I can get 1% of them to buy this book, gangbusters.
I know. It's brilliant, and part of me is jealous that he thought of that and, like, gets to do it, but he does it really well. And I have this experience, and I got to go here soon because I've got a thing at 9 o'clock, but I have this experience reading his books where I thoroughly enjoy them, but I wouldn't want to do this. You know what I mean? Like the writer in me wants to write, and I want to put myself in the stories, and I want to do pages and pages of analysis. Like, I don't want to interview Bo Jackson's third grade classmate. You know, like, no part of me really wants to do that. And yet it's the thing about those Perlman books that makes them so enjoyable. It's just kind of an interesting, like, I can assent from afar that this is well done, but I wouldn't want to do it myself.
Yeah. And he definitely, the reporter thing comes through because he's not trying to trace a narrative thread. So, like, in Lazenby's biography of Jordan, it seems to be there's sort of a question of, like, what made Michael Jordan?
Right.
And it's a narrative, and it's a really well researched one, really well sourced, but there's a thread of Jordan becoming Jordan.
Yes.
And Bo Jackson is more just like, well, who's Bo Jackson? And it's just all of these stuff. And he's actually starting from the place of like, man, everybody thinks they know who Bo Jackson is. Everybody knows.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Bo knows this and that and the other thing. And sort of starting from the place of legend and going, well, what's the backstory behind the legend? And so it allows for just a lot more of that, like, this was his upbringing, these were his family, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the reporter thing works so well in that context, which is the same for the the 80s Lakers, the 90s Cowboys, the USFL. There's sort of this like, oh yeah, everybody knows. Except what's the story behind what everybody knows?
Right, right. No, it's fascinating. He does it really well. One last quick question. Did you watch the 80s Lakers thing on HBO Max?
I have a really hard time watching fictionalized versions of real stuff if I know the real stuff at all.
Yes. Yeah.
So, like, you know, if I watch like the King's Speech, that's fictionalized of a real thing, except they're all dead and I didn't know who any of those people were anyway. But like the 80s Lakers, I'm like, I know who all these people are, and half of them are still involved in the league. This feels really uncomfortable to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. I totally get it. Pipe, we got to go. We've done what we always do in this program. In that we've gone almost an hour on books. We probably could do another hour. Honestly, we only scratched the surface of the categories. Maybe we'll do a part two next week.
But next time Ronnie lets us know morning of that he's not going to be on the show,
which will be next week. Yeah. I wonder if Ronnie is in Odessa, Texas, paying homage to the Permian Panthers. You know, this could be, it was right in front of us the whole time. He's there, man, at Ratliff Stadium.
If that was the case, I think my heart would actually split in half out of like pride and jealousy and shock. Yeah. Just gone.
That would be too much for us emotionally. Yes. That'd be a lot to deal with. But I agree. I would have the same experience. But there's a 0% chance of that happening. Although Ronnie does like sports movies. He never read Friday Night Lights, but he would watch the movie.
Would Ronnie do a sports pilgrimage to a fictionalized sports place? Like, getting Ronnie to go to a baseball game is, you know, I feel like that would be like pulling teeth. But getting Ronnie to go visit, like, the Field of Dreams?
Okay.
Would he?
Yeah. He might, dude. I think he would. I'll say this. I've been to a Major League Baseball game with Ronnie before. And it was a very interesting experience, right? This was like a decade ago. And I was in town maybe for grad school or something. And we went to Jacobs Field to watch the Indians. And it was like a couple of dudes from his church who were just like salt of the earth, Central Ohio dudes, like the kind of dudes that wear the jersey of the team to the game, right? They were like swinging by and picking us up for the game. And the game was an exercise in like Ronnie kind of being like, oh, I don't care about this. This is so dumb. You know, I can't believe people do this, you know, but also like kind of enjoying it at the same time. And it was pre-social media. So like there would have been no way for him to like leverage it. I'm sure his relationship with the experience would have been different now. But it was real fascinating to see him in that, you know, in that kind of setting. Like his friends were genuinely enjoying it. And I was like kind of enjoying it because I love pro baseball and but I don't care about the Indians, you know. And we were a zillion rows up and it was just kind of a thing to do. But yeah, I think we could get him. I think we could pretty confidently get him to the Field of Dreams field. I feel bullish on that.
Yeah, I feel like that's in the realm of like, yeah, I think he would do that.
Yeah, I do too. And or the gym from Hoosiers, dude. That's one we could easily make happen. That'd be like a 2.5 hour drive for him. He could just go like due west from Ashland and be there in a couple hours. I feel like that needs to happen. I've never seen that, which is shameful. Like, given that I grew up in Indiana and I spend a whole bunch of time there, I've never seen it. But, Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
God kept calling my heart. Like, I just knew he was my safe place.
I hope people don't walk away going, wow, you're really awesome. More than like, wow, Jesus is really interesting. And he's really awesome.
Everybody on this planet is dealing with some sort of what if.
How does that one courageous decision affect the whole world?
A ship in harbor is safe, but that's not what ships are built for.
If you were encouraged by what you just heard, please search Trevor Talks on your favorite podcast platform or lifeaudio.com.